Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ken Weinstein for the petitioners in this case. And we are asking the court in this case to do two things. First, to order EPA to hold an evidentiary hearing on the factual issues raised by the objections that the petitioners filed in this case. We have a right to a hearing under Section 408 of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, and we're asking the court to order that hearing.
You have a right to a hearing if certain thresholds are...
If certain thresholds are met.
Community Nutrition says that the way that we look at that threshold is an abuse of discretion standard.
Community Nutrition was an unusual case where there had already been a full hearing held on the safety of dry aspartame. And the petitioner asked...
The facts were no doubt different, but the statutory structure, the regulatory structure, was very similar to this, right? I mean, you have to argue that it was a different case, different circumstance, but certainly...
Well, the regulatory structure was similar in that case. It's similar in the Weinberger case in right. The Supreme Court. It's similar in the Hinson case, and the Pachter case. They're all dealing with hearing provisions of the FFDCA, and those cases all say that you can't grant summary judgment when there are genuine issues of material fact. I mean, that's the essence of what all of those cases are saying.
But
the
problem for our court, at least for me, is in trying to determine whether there are genuine issues of material fact, we're dealing with matters of enormous complexity here, aren't we? Isn't that why the court and Community Nutrition said, in that situation, it's an abuse of discretion standard because we have this great sense of deference in making those determinations?
I don't think so. I think that why they said it was an abuse of discretion standard in that case was because there had already been a full hearing, and the petitioner was asking for them to do a hearing all over again on the safety of just a slightly different substance. There were very similar issues, and in that case, I think the court was prepared to give more deference. But this is not that situation. Here, our product has been banned, and we don't have a hearing. And the statute says that the administrator shall grant a hearing.
If there's a material question of fact.
That's correct.
Okay. Let me try to get at the question a little differently. The question, then, is that's lurking in the debate you're just having with Judge Griffith is whether there is a genuine issue of material fact. I mean, if there is one, your position is you're entitled to a hearing.
That's correct.
The agency's position seems to be that, at least in some respects here, with respect to some of the issues, there isn't one because your request for a hearing simply recycled your comments. That is, that you can only create a genuine issue of material, an issue of material fact, by actually challenging the agency's final rule, that you have to have evidence that puts its final decision into question.
Well, of course, the agency has created a perfect catch-22.
Well, can I finish? Let me finish my question.
Oh, sorry.
My question was whether or not, I looked pretty carefully in your brief to figure out whether you were challenging that procedure. And I found some references in the reply brief, but not in the blue brief. Am I right that you're not here challenging the agency's rule that to raise a material question of fact, you have to raise it in response to the final rule and not just recycle your comments? Am I right that you're not challenging that procedure?
Well, we would challenge it because they're putting us in a catch.
Well, where did you challenge it in your brief?
I think we challenged it in our reply brief. I think we challenged it.
I know you challenged it in your reply brief.
Right.
I found that. But where in your opening brief? Because you know you have to challenge it there, not in the reply brief.
Right. Well, I think it was in response to EPA's argument.
Well, no, but EPA's final rule rejected your request for it. I'm sorry, they rejected your hearing for the same reason I'm just giving, namely that these were recycled comments, not objections to the final rule.
I thought that we did deal with the point that they were recycled comments, but when we...
In the brief?
I think we did, but...
You
want
to show me where when you...
I'll have to ask whether
okay.
We can look that up.
Okay.
But the real point is that we had a catch-22 because to the extent that we relied on what we said in the comments, EPA said, oh, we've already rejected your comments, and you should have said something new. To the extent we said something new, EPA said, oh, you can't say anything new. That's outside of the comment period.
Well, but I don't understand the EPA in this court to be relying on the latter proposition. Mm-hmm. I don't see them saying anywhere that your position here fails because you didn't raise it in a comment. I know they've taken that position in the rulemaking, but or in the denial of the objections, the hearing, but they don't argue that here.
Yes,
here they do.
They argue where? That in their brief.
Where? They argue quite vociferously that they have the ability to reject an objection if it wasn't raised in a comment. But
they did.
Let me finish my question.
Yes, sir.
But I couldn't find any specific examples with respect to the surface water or the groundwater or any other issues where their position is that your argument fails because your position wasn't raised in a comment. Their position here seems to be that you didn't raise a question of material fact because you didn't raise it with respect to the final rule. You didn't challenge the agency's final decision. You just restated your comments.
Well, to the extent, we added a lot in our objections, and I think they went all over the board in objecting to EPA's.
You added the FIFRA proposal, right?
Excuse me?
You added the FIFRA proposal.
We did.
Okay. So that was added, but it wasn't rejected on the ground that it should have been in the comment period.
I think it was.
I thought it was rejected on the ground that it is, until that's resolved. It can't be the basis for this proceeding.
That was one point, and I think that's fallacious because just because you submit an application under FIFRA, it doesn't mean that you can't also say in the FFDCA proceeding, we think this is a less restrictive alternative that you should consider in the FFDCA proceeding, and you're obliged to rule on that because we raised it in the objections.
Well, until it's approved as under FIFRA, how could it be taken into account in this proceeding?
I think that regardless of whether we had raised it under FIFRA, it must be taken into account because it's a less restrictive alternative. And the law is EPA has to consider less restrictive alternatives to a complete product ban. So these were less restrictive alternatives to find ways to make the product safe.
In addition to saying it wasn't timely, the agency went on and said they didn't trust self-regulation, right? They responded to your proposal.
There is
precedent. Didn't say you should have raised it in the comment period.
Isn't that a question for the ALJ? I mean, we presented credible expert testimony saying that this was a feasible method of enforcement and making sure that...
Is that a factual question?
That's a factual question.
It's not like a policy question. They said they had reasons for not wanting to pursue that road, go down that road. That didn't seem to depend upon a particular fact.
The question is whether it's legally enforceable and whether it's practical. And it's legally enforceable because you make it a condition of the FIFRA registration and the label that you must report.
But the FIFRA proceeding's still out there.
Right.
They couldn't rely on that.
No, but the judge in the ALJ proceeding can say, I think that this product is safe if you adopt these restrictions, and then it's up to what happens in the FIFRA proceeding to decide whether or not to do that.
Well, that'd be sort of gratuitous on the part of the ALJ, wouldn't it?
I don't think it would be gratuitous because the ALJ would be saying these restrictions would make the product safe, and if you have them,
the agency's position, as I understand it, is that if the FIFRA proposal is adopted in a FIFRA proceeding, then you can come back with this alternative.
Well, there's been no movement to do anything like that. I think that we did this as a matter of good faith to show we were serious about these label changes. But the point was that there's no reason that they can't be considered under FIFRA while they're being considered in the FFDCA proceeding, because the ALJ can say, I find that these restrictions would make the product safe. If you adopt these restrictions, it's safe.
I just have a factual question for you. Are you saying that the limitations you proposed in the FIFRA proceedings were included in your comments before the agency? The same ones?
To some extent they were.
No,
but
no, not to some extent.
To some extent they were.
Did you propose the major part of your FIFRA proceedings was this 2% cap, right?
Yes, that was one.
Did you propose that in the comments?
We did not propose that in the comments.
Instead, that was no, you didn't, because instead you argued that the pesticide was not used on more than 4% of the crops.
And that creates a triable issue of fact.
Well, no, but then you lost that.
Because there should have been a hearing on that issue. Right? That's a battle of experts on that issue.
Right. But the agency rejected that, I think, because it wasn't responsive to its reason for rejecting your comments. It didn't respond to their 100% assumption.
It did respond to the 100% assumption. They said that 100% of the crops are treated. And that was just an assumption. We have actual sales data that show that it was 1% to 4%.
The sales data don't correspond to the watersheds, right?
They do. In fact, our experts did a mapping of the counties, because the sales data correspond to counties.
They
showed that using conservative assumptions, the exposures would not exceed the safe level if you adopted the
4%. Isn't there a problem just with the link between sales and usage? I mean, that's not necessarily a close fit, is it?
It's a pretty good fit, and that's something that the experts would testify to at the hearing. I mean, those are issues of credibility.
Can I circle back to my original question about the standard of review here? Where in community nutrition does it tell us that the standard of review adopted there was because there had been a prior hearing? That is the facts of the case, but that's not the explanation the court itself gave for its standard of review.
I think in the opinion, the court said that this case is heavily influenced by the background, and the background of the case was that there were the two.
It also said in 1363, our scope of review is necessarily deferential. The judiciary is ill-equipped to conduct investigations and analyze facts of the type involved in this case.
Well, we're talking about a summary judgment, and this court reviews summary judgment issues de novo, whether they're antitrust issues, patent issues, copyright issues,
all kinds of technical issues. It's not summary judgment, right?
It's a summary judgment-like procedure, but the point is to determine whether there are genuine issues of material fact. That's something that the Court of Appeals does de novo, regardless of the type of proceeding. It doesn't take expertise
to do
that.
Suppose we don't agree with you about that. That is that our review is de novo because this is entitled summary judgment. Let's assume we just don't agree with you about that. Do you have any other argument that we should be reviewing this de novo? I mean, that's your whole argument.
Review?
Yeah. That's your whole argument, right?
Our argument is that EPA is required to follow its regulations. The regulations provide the criteria. EPA has no discretion to deviate from those criteria. And
what's that got to do with our review?
Your role?
Yeah, our review. You're just arguing with Judge Griffith about whether it's de novo. I was just asking
whether
there's anything more to your argument other than this is entitled summary judgment, and that when we review a summary judgment decision from a district court, we review it de novo. That's your argument, right?
Our argument is that the procedure is a summary judgment-like procedure, and it involves the same issues, and therefore the review.
And if we reject your argument that we should review this de novo because we review district court decisions de novo, in other words, if we see a difference between an appeal from a district court and an administrative agency that calls its procedure summary judgment, if we see a difference there, then do you have a backup argument about de novo review?
I don't know if I have a back argument on de novo review. That is the standard that, we found in the law for review of summary judgment, and that no deference would be granted. And that was under a summary judgment standard. The evidence must be so strong and persuasive that no reasonable fact finder is free to disregard it. And that was Rogers v. EPA.
But whether something is material is first passed on by the agency here.
Under the regulations.
Yeah.
And they have to apply the regulations.
And that puts the standard for materiality into a different light than it would be if it were a district court passing on it, because the district court has no claim to expertise.
Right.
But passing that, Mr. Weinstein, you said specifically that it wasn't just county data, that your submission mapped the data onto watersheds.
That's right.
I've just gone through 654 to 675 without finding that, any reference to watersheds. So where is
Sal's data? The experts mapped the counties onto the watersheds.
Where is that to be seen?
We'll try to look that up. But that's the way they did it. So they had a conservative assessment.
At the comment stage.
They did it at the comment stage, and they did it, that was submitted at the comment stage.
So when you were rejected in part, or on one ground, because county data don't respond to watersheds, you're saying that was erroneous on the part of the agency because you'd provided watershed data.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay,
and
well, I'd like to see it.
Opinion.
I want to see the data.
Excuse me?
I want to see the data or where it is. I can't find it.
Okay.
And we want to see the data in the comments.
In the comments,
that's what we're talking about.
In the comments.
Right.
Not later, but in the comments.
In the comments. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we shouldn't.
Who's next?
I just had another question.
Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. Is he out of time?
Go on.
Oh, okay. I wanted to ask you a question about the the groundwater issue.
Yes.
And you rely on this leaching study. Now, the agency says, EPA says, that the problem with the leaching study is that it suffers from the same problem that your 90% rule does. That is, the agency said the problem with your 90% rule is that there are areas that are less than 90% that are equally vulnerable, and that's why they reject it. And they said the leaching studies suffers from the same problem. Is that right?
I think that's totally wrong, because uh-huh. what the experts did was they said, look, if it's more than 90%, it's automatically out,
yeah.
and there's going to be no applications because
well, you're going to answer my question about whether the leaching study was based on your 90%.
No, it was based. What the leaching study did was say, if you have more than 90% sand, it's too porous, and it's out. You can't apply carbofuran in that area.
And
if it's less than
90%,
it would be evaluated. The experts evaluated 64,000 geographical locations where they had soil samples in the areas where the product could be applied, and so they had actual data as to the soil in each of those areas, and they found, based on their modeling, that the levels that got into groundwater from all of those areas would be below the safe level.
So 90%, right?
Hmm?
90%.
No, 90% was simply a cutoff that said anything that's more than 90% is automatically off the table. We won't apply it there. Mm-hmm. If it's less than 90%, it had to be evaluated by the experts, 64,000 separate locations, and they evaluated the soil in each location. And that analysis, that leaching analysis, showed that
and
the amounts
where, would be I asked the same question that Judge Ginsburg asked you about the sales data. Where would I find this in the comments, the explanation you just gave me?
In the comments?
Yeah.
I have the citations to the record in the appendix at 1116 and 1490, but I'll have to check to make sure that that was in the comments. So,
and what were the sites you just gave us?
1116 and 1490.
And is that where, and what is that document you're referring to? That joint appendix, what is that? Is that the response to the final rule?
That was where EPA changed their assumptions in the final order.
Is that a document? Is that your request for a hearing that you're citing?
I think that's the agency document where they changed the assumptions.
Oh, I was asking where your clients made the argument that about the 90%. That's what I was asking you.
Right.
Where would I find that? Because when I look at your own material, it says, I'm reading at Joint Appendix 1339, it says, it's describing the leaching study. It says the mitigation analysis, quote, assumed soils having the same content, having sand content greater or equal to 90%.
Yes.
That's why I was asking you the question.
It assumed that those soils are going to be banned, that those soils would not be.
And where would I find the further explanation that below 90% they might also be banned?
That would be in the leaching study itself, I believe.
You want to give me those sites?
The comments would be 638 through 647.
Okay.
So,
I will give you a couple minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Weinstein.
All right, thank you.
May it please the Court, Alan Greenberg with the United States Department of Justice, representing Respondent Environmental Protection Agency. With me at council table is Laurel Celeste of the United States Environmental Protection Agency. In this case, to prevail on petitioner's request for a hearing, petitioners must win on three of the four issues that they have presented. They must be entitled to a hearing on the surface water issue. They must show that they're entitled to a hearing on the groundwater issue, and they must show that they're entitled to a hearing either on the half-life issue or on the safety factors issue.
And none of that's relevant to the import issue, is it?
None of that is relevant to the import issue. The import issue is not a request for hearing, Your Honor. There's not a disputed issue of fact, and I think they concede that.
Right. So whether they prevail on the import matter doesn't depend on the three things you've just raised.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay,
why is the safety question dependent on the other issues?
Your Honor, the
in other words, if they lose on groundwater and surface water, why does that automatically resolve the safety question?
Because if the surface water levels are not safe, then they are not, they cannot prevail. It's an outcome determinative factor here.
But suppose the agency's wrong on the safety factors. That doesn't affect the...
It doesn't, because their arguments under the safety factors, even assuming all of their assumptions are adopted, would only reduce the numbers by a factor of 400. And because, by a factor of 40. So the...
Well, they're objecting to a tenfold multiplier here.
They're objecting to one tenfold multiplier and one fourfold multiplier.
Okay,
that's a 40-fold multiplier,
right?
Because some of the levels under surface water, the exposures to infants, are more than 40 times above the safe level.
But even didn't the agency use less than tenfold?
Pardon?
Didn't the agency use less than a tenfold for...
Cumulatively, the agency used a 400-fold factor, 10 for interspecies, 10 for intraspecies, and 4 for the child safety factor.
4 for the child. Yeah, that's what I meant. They didn't use 10 for the child.
No, they did 4. So that's how you get to 400.
I see.
10 times 10 times 4.
I got that.
They are not disputing one of the 10s, but they are disputing the 10
okay,
for...
Okay, gotcha. I understand that. Thank you. Okay, great. Okay.
This court is reviewing a case under the Administrative Procedure Act and the familiar standard under the APA. And as Judge Griffith mentioned, the relevant standard was articulated in the Community Nutrition Institute case. We are not reviewing this case as a summary judgment by a district court. Rather, we're reviewing the application by EPA of regulations to particular facts, and those facts and the application of those regulations to the facts are reviewed under the arbitrary and capricious standard. That was the standard in community nutrition. It's also the standard that the Hinson Court applied and that was cited by the petitioners. In particular, the Community Nutrition Court held that the review is deferential, particularly as to scientific and technical issues, and also held that differences in weight as to particular scientific studies is insufficient to overturn an agency denial. The arguments made by counsel for petitioners relating to the relevance of community nutrition do not withstand scrutiny. It is true that the agency had held a hearing on the dry uses of aspartame earlier, several years before the community nutrition case. But the community nutrition case is a case just like this one. Petitioners in that case sought a hearing based upon arguments they made below in the agency process, and this court held in evaluating whether a hearing should be granted, looked to whether the arguments made, whether the petitioners had submitted evidence that raised a material issue of fact. And in that case, the issues that the petitioners had raised with respect to the wet use of aspartame did not raise those issues. And the court applied the appropriate deferential standard, just as this court should do in this case.
They came in on groundwater, on surface water, with data showing that the percentage of crops treated was about 4.25%, right?
They made arguments in the comment period that their sales data to distributors allowed them to make some kind of calculation relating to the use of carbofuran on particular farms in particular
water.
There
couldn't be any greater use than there were sales.
Pardon?
Use could not exceed sales.
Use could exceed sales if the farmer had bought the carbofuran the year before and had it stored and then chose to use it in the current year.
Okay, so assuming profligate farmers who overbuy 100% of their needs, that would take you up to 8.5%.
Perhaps, Your Honor, but the key here is, first, they did not submit their sales data as part of the comment period. That sales data was submitted in November.
It was submitted before the proposal, I think.
No, Your Honor.
Is that right? No? Okay,
the data, the actual data they submitted that they relied on was not submitted until November. In fact, the cover letter
That's some months before the final rule comes out.
It is some months.
So are you saying that the agency didn't consider that because it was late?
As part of its final rule, it did not consider it because it was not submitted during the comment period, Your Honor.
I thought it responded to it.
It did.
We responded to it because...
Well, you couldn't respond to it without considering it.
We responded to the argument by saying we assume it's sales data, and we said the sales data would not be adequate because we don't know how you are converting sales to distributors to particular uses in particular watersheds. There was just way too much uncertainty in doing percent crop treated, which is what the agency articulated in their final rule. And the agency said in the final rule that the data you have submitted, which doesn't include the sales data and which doesn't include how you convert sales data from actual use at a particular farm in a particular watershed in a particular pest control situation, the lack of that data results in the retention of sufficient uncertainty such that the agency cannot meet the statutory standard. That the petitioners cannot prevail on that argument because they cannot show to a reasonable certainty that there will be no harm from use.
The agency, I thought, went on to assume that it could be 100% crops treated.
That is our assumption because...
Why is that a reasonable assumption is what I'm asking.
It's a reasonable assumption because the agency cannot determine to a reasonable certainty a lower percent crop treated. The label...
Even though the sales are what they are, and there's never been any report of any kind of problem with the substance or incidence of that kind of approaching 100% anywhere, you assumed 100%.
We assume the 100% because under the label, it can be sold to 100%. And if in a particular watershed in a particular year there's a significant pest infestation or there is a significant need for that particular product, for those particular crops, it would be permissible for 100%.
Why is it reasonable to assume that because something is permissible, it might happen when it's never happened and it would be rather extraordinary?
Well, we don't know it's never happened, Your Honor. We have sales data that's aggregated at a level above the watershed level. And in a small watershed, if there was a pest infestation in that particular watershed, we don't know what the percent crop treated would be. And the statute that Congress enacted required EPA to set a level of a tolerance that would assure to a reasonable certainty that no harm would result. And that is the standard that EPA has to apply to determine whether proffered facts are outcome determinative in this case. That's the holding of Liberty Lobby, among other cases, that you have to apply the evidentiary standard applicable to the merits of the case when addressing whether a summary judgment type proffer has met the threshold for raising a material issue of fact. Materiality is based upon that appropriate evidentiary standard. Your Honor,
I'd like to ask you about this leaching study, about the groundwater question.
Yes, Your Honor.
They say the leaching study, it shows that carbofuran usage would not exceed 1.1 parts per billion. And so what's your reaction to the discussion I was having with your opponent there about why the agency rejected this leaching study?
A couple of responses, yeah. Your Honor. First of all, the petitioners did not submit the leaching study during the comment period.
Yeah, but do you make that point? Do you argue that in this case? That's not your position in this case here, is it, that it's waived?
Is it part of our argument, Your Honor, but we've emphasized the...
I couldn't find it at all. Do you argue in your brief that...
We have argued in our brief that that issues that were not raised during the comment period that could have been raised during the comment period.
I know that's the agency's position, but you argue with respect to this issue?
With this specific issue, we did not...
That's what I thought.
Make that particular argument.
Okay, so what is the agency's position on the leaching study? It's not that it's forfeited, it's something else. And I thought it was that the agency was saying that the leaching study suffers from the same problem the 90% assumption suffers from.
Well, it's two things. First of all, Your Honor, because they did not submit the leaching study during the comment period, EPA and its final rule articulated several problems
with
the leaching study and the uncertainty associated with it, particularly do the geographic restrictions that petitioners proffered encompass all of the vulnerable areas in which carbofuran would pose a risk to groundwater. And we identified, EPA in the final rule, identified gaps in the data and inadequate analysis that petitioners did not address in their final request for hearing. So in that sense, the fact that the leaching study was not provided, EPA identified problems with the assertions, which were unsupported by the scientific
data. And what were those
data.
Problems? What were the problems?
They primarily relate to the fact that petitioners assumed this 90% greater than sand, less than 1% organic content would capture all of the vulnerable areas.
Okay, well, counsel just told me that isn't true, that, in fact, even if it's under 90%, it could be prohibited if it's in a vulnerable area.
As we understood the leaching study, they used the 90%, 1% as their criteria for whether something was in or not. Perhaps they made some additional adjustment for specific areas, but EPA noted that the amount of sand in a particular field can vary acre to acre. The amount of organic material can vary acre to acre. We identified areas in Wisconsin. We identified the fact that in Texas and other states where carbofuran continued to be authorized for use, there are areas in which the sand and the organic content creates vulnerabilities, and that created uncertainty with respect to the proffer. And that uncertainty was not addressed by petitioners in their request for hearing.
I want to ask you about these import tolerances.
Yes, Your Honor.
Even if there was something ambiguous about their comments, what about this December 08 letter? It looks awfully clear to me. They said they wanted to make clear that even if the agency wasn't to agree as to the combined exposure from import tolerances, we are requesting that EPA evaluate the import tolerances themselves on a standalone basis.
Yes, Your Honor. That came after the close of the comment period.
Yeah, but the agency did not reject it for that reason. It didn't reject it for that reason then, and it doesn't argue that now. At least I couldn't find it.
No, we did reject it in the final rule that it was not raised in the comment period, and in our denial of the request for review of the objections, we articulated in our argument that it was not a timely request. And we then also noted that the petitioners...
So I'm wrong when I thought that this was not the basis for rejecting it?
Primary basis for objecting it, Your Honor.
I mean, you're telling me if I go back and look at both the final rule and the rejection of the hearing, I will find in there that one of the reasons for rejecting this is that it came after the comment period?
That will certainly be a basis in the final rule, Your Honor, because...
No, you're saying I'll find it when I go back and look. It's there?
I believe it is, Your Honor. Uh-huh. But the primary basis for rejecting the argument was that the basket of uses the petitioners have continued to request include domestic uses in addition to the import tolerances.
But you concede they're safe, right? Haven't you conceded they're safe? So what possible basis could there be for revoking the tolerances here?
Because, Your Honor, at the current time, under FIFRA, these are still registered uses. There are some non-food uses associated with with carbofuran, pine seedlings, other seed uses. And until the petitioners or someone else from the public comes in and says, we are not seeking to use carbofuran anywhere within the United States.
They don't have to say that, as long as they're separately saying they'd like to import some.
Right.
But until they say that we're not going to see domestic uses and the domestic water supply potentially contaminated.
Is this some kind of a plea bargain? They have to give up something to get something to which they're entitled? If they say we want it for imports, and imports are concededly safe, you say, well, you can't have it for imports unless you say that's all you want it for, right?
Yes, Your Honor, because...
Why? They said we'd like it for everything, but if we can't have it for everything, we'd like it for imports.
Because they've also said, well, we'd like it for imports and one of the other uses, and imports and
right,
two
right,
of the other uses.
You've denied all that. Right. Why would that extend to imports?
That's not what the letter says anyway.
The letter says twice. Clarify FMC's position. Request that EPA consider the import tolerances for bananas, etc., by themselves. Page 2.
And then it
in
goes on.
In addition to requesting, consider the import tolerances on a standalone basis.
Right. And then it goes on to ask for us to consider the import tolerances.
Well,
with
that's
other...
an argument in the alternative. What's wrong with that? They're saying we'd like to have everything. If we can't have everything, we want the imports.
Because it's not the burden on the agency to do all the various permutations of the various uses that the petitioners currently have to choose which one might be best.
What is the burden you're talking about of answering this letter by saying, what would be the burden of saying, okay, well, imports we found are safe, so we'll leave that alone?
Because we would also, under this letter, presumably have had to ask, are import tolerances with soybeans safe? Then do that approval. Would import tolerances with soybean and corn be safe? Then approve it that way. If import tolerances with corn...
They didn't ask for that. They've asked for import tolerances, and they listed four things.
and then if you turn the page, they ask for the remaining sets of uses and combinations of uses.
But the agency conceded that imports are not a problem, right? Maybe I have a basic misunderstanding. If the stuff is imported in connection with produce, right, the public is exposed to is the residue.
Correct, Your Honor.
Right? No groundwater concern, no surface water concern. And the agency, I thought, had determined that the residue is safe, even in the domestic production. It's the groundwater and surface water and so on that's problematic.
In the final rule, yes, Your Honor. It's the surface water and groundwater.
And I failed to see the logic of denying the imports.
The logic, Your Honor, is that it is the burden of the public or the registrant to identify the particular basket that they would like EPA to to approve. It is not EPA's burden to go through the various uses.
How about these imports? That was the basket they would like approved. And in their basket, they've got bananas and rice, you know, like any checkout counter.
Okay. If we don't agree with you on this, on the import, would you agree that we then would vacate that part of the final rule? Right?
It would be subject to, yes, Your Honor.
We would vacate it, right.
It would not affect the other issues in the request.
Correct, but it would also be, we would vacate it, right? It would be the end of the matter, correct? Mm. With respect to imports, that's all.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
There wouldn't be an evidentiary hearing on that.
Right. No, there would be no evidentiary hearing on that.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Greenberg.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Give you 2 minutes, Mr. Weinstein.
Thank you very much. So to address Judge Tatel's question as to whether EPA reviewed information that was not submitted in the comment period, EPA says in the final order, EPA did not review the information submitted after the close of the comment period. I think that was confirmed by Mr. Greenberg this morning. So they didn't consider the sales data that we submitted. They didn't consider the usage cap. They didn't consider the national leaching study. They didn't consider
On the leaching study, didn't they? They did consider it, and they said it suffered from a variety of defects.
They said that mm-hmm. they weren't going to consider it because it wasn't submitted within the comment period, and they said
you just heard government counsel say they consider it and identified the problems with it. Is that not accurate?
I believe that what they said was we submitted a supplemental leaching study to address what you heard Mr. Greenberg say, that there were new areas in Wisconsin, new scenarios that showed that our modeling was not right and their modeling showed the levels were too high and were safe. So in our objections, we came back and we submitted responses to that, a new supplement to the leaching study. They didn't consider it. It was outside of the comment period. They didn't consider it. Not considering the sales data is key, because the sales data, a reasonable expert could say those sales data show that the 100% assumption is wrong. It's more like 4%. And the levels that you're going to get in surface water are below the safe level. So if you consider the sales data, there's credible evidence from which a neutral fact finder could find the product to be safe. Same thing is true regarding the leaching study and the restriction not to apply the product near groundwater wells, which EPA refused to consider. That's valid and credible scientific information that shows that the levels in groundwater would be safe. And this was done in response to changes that EPA made in the final order. They wouldn't let us respond to changes that they made in the final order because of this doctrine, this waiver doctrine, that anything not submitted in the comment period is out.
Do you agree, by the way, that with counsel that if, let's assume we decide that you're not entitled to a hearing on surface and groundwater, do you agree with him that there's no reason for us to address the other issues? Except for the FIFRA issue and the import question. In other words, there's no need for us to consider the half-life question or the safety issue.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
We agree. We have to prevail on surface water and groundwater in order to show the product is safe.
Right.
But we have submitted credible evidence on all of those issues.
I understand. I just wanted to be sure that you agreed with him on that
We've
point.
Submitted credible evidence even without the FIFRA amendments. Before and without the FIFRA amendments, there's credible evidence, scientific evidence in the record that shows that a neutral fact finder could find in favor of us and find that that this is safe. That includes the sales data for the surface water issue, and it includes the leaching data for the groundwater issue. Those were submitted within the comment period, and they demonstrate, at very least, a triable issue of fact, which experts might disagree on, as to whether those levels are safe. So even if you disregard the FIFRA amendment part of it, we've demonstrated a core amount of credible scientific evidence from which a fact finder could find these products are safe. I think that's very important. And if you've seen the record, it's a very extensive record here. If the petitioners here are not entitled to a hearing on these issues, having submitted 12 expert reports and more than 75 scientific studies on these issues, I don't think that anyone is ever going to get a hearing.
You think we should weigh them instead of just reading them and deciding whether they're responsive?
Well, you know, there's a lot there, but it
rarely determines the result here.
I think in district court they'd certainly pass the test for avoiding summary judgment, and I think the test here is intended to be similar. That's what the Supreme Court said in Weinberger. Unless you can say conclusively that there's no genuine issue of fact, you have to have a hearing. That's what the Ninth Circuit said. That's what the Fourth Circuit said. Everybody is saying, unless you can say conclusively that there's no factual issue, Congress wanted a hearing to be held. And that's the language of the statute. They said a hearing shall be held if EPA makes these findings. And those findings are defined in their regulations as to how they should make them.
Thank you, Mr. Weinstein.
Thank you.
Mr. Greenberg, thank you. Case is submitted.
Give me about 2 minutes. Go ahead. It's 7440.
Thank you.
Hey, how are you?